Today is Monday, January 3rd, 2022, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. A Sudanese analyst says Sudan's future looks even more bleak after Prime Minister Hamdok's resignation.
For now, I see the streets are in control now, and that Burhan has no option but to enter dialogue of handing power to the PA, to the civilians.
President Biden's chief medical advisor says the spike in COVID cases threatens the entire U.S. healthcare system.
When you have multi-fold more people getting infected, the net amount is you're still going to get a lot of people that are going to be needing hospitalization.
And Kenyan authorities pursue suspected terrorists who killed six people Monday near the Somali border. We'll have these stories and more next. Sudan was plunged into further political turmoil on Sunday when Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok resigned, citing his failure to ensure a peaceful transition to democracy. Hamdok said in a televised speech Sunday, "I tried as much as I could to avoid our country slipping into a catastrophe, and now our country is going through a dangerous turning point that may threaten its entire survival if it's not remedied soon." His speech came just hours after security forces killed three protesters, according to the pro-democracy Central Committee of Sudan Doctors. At least 57 people have been killed since the coup, according to the Doctors' Committee. The military overthrew Hamdok in October, then reinstated him in November after he signed a power-sharing deal. We now turn to Jihad Mashamoun, a Sudanese researcher and analyst based in Britain. He says Sudan's political future is looking increasingly bleak. He tells me he believes General Al-Burhan will ask for immunity in exchange for stepping down.
For now, I see the streets are in control now, and that Burhan has no option but to enter dialogue of handing power to the PA, to the civilians. And by saying handing dialogue, it doesn't mean that they're going to be a partnership, any more partnership. I don't see the possibility of a partnership with Al-Burhan in the helms of it, Burhan and his allies. So I see is a dialogue happening to hand over power in exchange for Burhan getting an immunity. Burhan and his allies, Burhan and Hamiti, his deputy.
You believe he's going to try to go for immunity and then step down from the government?
He's not going to say it. I mean, that's a problem with Sudanese general and all of us Sudanese in general, Carol. We're not explicit, we're implicit. That's our problem. And Burhan is too proud to say that he wants immunity. He's not going to say it. But if you look at what he did in Darfur, in the genocide, him and Hamiti, and the ending of the protest site, that explains why both of them want to become president or leaders of Sudan, because they want the immunity with it, to avoid prosecution or being thrown in prison. Now, Hamiti is a little bit different because he has presidential ambitions. He came from rags to riches. That's why he has presidential ambitions. He believes he can go for the top position. But Burhan, he wants an immunity, and that's why he wants the presidency in the post-transition elections.
But doesn't Burhan also want power, and that's why he's been doing what he's doing with the whole military takeover there in October? Where do you see the future political government? What will happen with the government, if there is one, in Sudan?
But Burhan wants power because of the changes he was doing in the military, is that he wants to ensure that the military won't descend against him and remove him. That's why he wants power. Usually the military would revolt during civilian protests. When they see civilians out in the streets and they don't want to go back, the military junior officers and middle-ranking officers, they will revolt against senior commanders. In general, the military institutions, they don't want officers to rebel from within. And that's a Burhan. That's why he wants power, because he doesn't want officers to rebel. And that's why he's been cleaning their military of any potential enemies.
Well, do you think it's even possible now to go back and try to, you know, turn back the clock and have some sort of power-sharing government between civilian leaders and military leaders in Sudan?
With Burhan and Hamiti, I doubt it. I doubt that possibility. With some other military forces, yes, there is going to be a partnership, but it's going to be a severely limited partnership in terms of the military. It will have a severely limited role that they can't manipulate like Al-Burhan did before.
That was Jihad Mashamoun, a Sudanese political analyst and honorary scholar of Arab and Islamic studies at the University of Exeter in England. He was speaking with me earlier Monday. Kenyan authorities say they are pursuing suspected Al-Shabaab terrorists who killed 6 people early Monday in Lamu County on the border with Somalia. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's Lamu County Commissioner Irungu Macharia says suspected Al-Shabaab militants attacked and killed villagers early Monday in the county's Wediu area. However, there was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Macharia says they are pursuing the suspects into the forest. He says they might also be hiding among the population. Macharia says they are seeking the public's help to trace the criminals. Kenya's Citizen TV reported at least one victim was shot, one hacked to death with a machete, and others were burned alive. VOA could not independently verify the accounts. Wediu area residents say the attackers also torched several houses, though some residents speaking to local media questioned if the violence was the work of the Islamist militants or related to local politics. The Nation Media Group quoted some locals saying most of the attackers were carrying machetes, whereas Al-Shabaab militants are commonly armed with guns. Macharia says they have deployed more security forces to the area.
But we have beefed up security in the county.
He says they have beefed up security in the county and to make sure that Kenyans and their properties are safe. Al-Shabaab are known to hide out in the Boni Forest in northeast Kenya's Lamu County on the border with Somalia. The Somali terrorist group launches sporadic attacks on villages and public transport. On Saturday, a man riding a motorcycle was killed when he ran over a roadside bomb in the Kiungu area of Lamu, on the border with Somalia, near the Indian Ocean coast. Kenyan security officials blamed Al-Shabaab for setting off the explosives. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The fifth wave of the coronavirus pandemic continues moving across the world, infecting the unvaccinated and vaccinated alike. The newest variant, Omicron, has already led to thousands of flight cancellations in the United States in the new year. U.S. President Biden has promised the availability of 500 million rapid tests as American school children return to class. VOA's Aras Arabazadi has more.
More than 9,200 U.S. domestic and international flights were delayed or canceled on New Year's Day due to bad weather and surging cases of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. That's according to the flight tracking website FlightAware.com. By Sunday, another 2,200 flights met the same fate. Chicago's O'Hare Airport was packed.
Last year, I was traveling. There was no one here, which was kind of eerie. So I like to see the people, but this is a lot of people.
While the Omicron variant appears less likely to cause severe illness, U.S. President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, warned spiking infections threaten the entire healthcare system.
Even if you have less of a percentage of severity, when you have multi-fold more people getting infected, the net amount is you're still going to get a lot of people that are going to be needing hospitalization. And that's the reason why we're concerned about stressing and straining the hospital system.
As school children in the U.S. return to classes this week, Fauci's message remains clear.
I plead with parents to please seriously consider vaccinating your children, wearing masks in the school setting, doing test-to-stay approaches when children get infected. I think all of those things put together, it's safe enough to get those kids back to school.
New York City's new mayor, Eric Adams, who was sworn in on Saturday, tells ABC's This Week that the nation's biggest city is ready for school to restart.
We're going to create a safe environment with testing. We're going to identify the children that are exposed. We're going to remove them from that environment. The numbers show the mere fact that a child is exposed in a classroom does not mean that an entire classroom is exposed.
Adams takes office as New York City grapples with record numbers of cases driven by the Omicron variant. Classes resume Monday there and around the country. Aras Arabazadi, VOA News.
The virus is something people are going to have to learn to live with for decades, says infectious disease physician Dr. Amish Adalja, who is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in Baltimore, Maryland.
COVID-19 is something not only that we will have to live with for the rest of our lives, but all of our descendants will have to live with for the rest of their lives. This is a new virus that's established itself in the human species. It is not going anywhere. We will have COVID cases 100 years from now. This is not something that can go magically back into bats. That's why it's so important that people use the tools that we have like vaccines to be able to better risk calculate in a world in which COVID-19 is ever present. There will always be a baseline number of COVID cases, hospitalizations, and even deaths, but it's going to be a much more manageable public health problem as immunity rises in the population and as more tools are developed to cope with it. But this is now another disease that we will deal with every time we walk out the door, but it's going to be something that does not have the same risk as it did in its early days.
Does that mean that it will be the new normal, I guess, to wear face masks everywhere you go in public?
There may be some people that will continue to wear face masks for COVID-19 protection and for protection against other respiratory viruses, but I suspect other people will move away from that practice as they get much more risk acclimatized to this new threat. I think that we'll see that there are going to be off-ramps for some of the public health mitigation measures that are put into place. And I think protection from severe disease is enough for me to start to say that you don't need to do all of this in general. There may be some people, especially immunocompromised people and high-risk people, that may continue to do that, but I don't think from a public health standpoint or a public health guidance standpoint, it would be something that would be mandatory.
That was Dr. Amish Adalja with Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He was speaking with me late last week from Baltimore, Maryland. U.S. schools are adapting in different ways for a return from the holiday break as COVID cases surge. AP correspondent Julie Walker has that story.
New York State is providing millions of at-home test kits to schools for students to take home. Governor Kathy Hochul said on Friday the statewide test-to-stay program is meant to keep kids in school after a classmate tests positive.
Kids need to go back. We've said this for so many reasons why it's just not an option to keep our children home after what they had to go through last time.
The CDC has endorsed Test to Stay, and other school districts across the country are adopting the program, along with making masks in class again mandatory, with some like DC even making vaccines mandatory starting in March. But other school systems like Atlanta and Newark are switching to remote learning while the surge continues. I'm Julie Walker.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke by phone over the weekend. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell tells me that Biden reiterated his support for Ukraine amid Russia's massive military buildup along the Ukraine border, including discussions over what the White House calls the Ukraine Confidence Building Initiative.
The Ukraine Confidence Building Initiative is a USAID project that's been working in the Donbas region of Ukraine. It's basically like a civic democratization initiative, and it has three goals, basically to increase acceptance of Ukrainian civic identity based on common values, to broaden participation in Ukraine's reform process, and to build trust and acceptance of objective pro-reform information. And so what you could take from all of this in the context of this call is that the Biden administration has said that they want a diplomatic path out of conflict. They want to address challenges around the world with diplomacy, with information, with confidence building measures. And that is basically exactly what they're doing here in Ukraine.
As we know with the Biden-Putin talks, Putin was saying to Biden that, you know, he wants to see no further expansion of NATO in Eastern Europe. Did Mr. Biden and Mr. Zelensky talk about that?
According to the limited information we have of this call between Presidents Biden and Zelensky, they kind of just touched on NATO and touched on the fact that NATO is going to be having talks coming up in the coming week, but didn't say anything specifically about Ukraine's ambitions to join the security alliance. And the U.S. position on this has been pretty consistent, which is that anyone is welcome to apply to join NATO, and no country can unilaterally say, hey, you can't join. They can't block anybody, so they have to go through the process. But they didn't mention this at all in this readout of this call. It was almost certainly talked about. That's one of the big issues. And Putin has been very clear on this, but it doesn't look like they reached any sort of firm resolution against it or in terms of like satisfying Putin's demands.
Can you refresh our memory and tell us what are the upcoming meetings that are happening between the U.S. and some of the European powers?
Sure. So in the coming days, we're going to have three sets of high-level talks, none of which are going to involve, we think, the heads of state. But these are high-level talks between like senior foreign ministry officials. First of all, we have coming up the bilateral talks between the U.S. and Russia. Those are going to be very interesting. Those are going to be held in Geneva, and those are not going to include either president. Then we have talks with the NATO-Russia Council, which are, of course, multi-party talks, and then more talks at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which, again, is a multi-party organization. So the U.S. is going to participate in all of these and hopefully, I guess, try to find some sort of path forward that doesn't escalate into conflict and bloodshed.
That was VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell talking with me Monday about the phone call between U.S. President Biden and Ukrainian President Zelensky. Twitter on Sunday said it permanently banned the personal account of Republican U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene for tweets that repeatedly violated the social media's misinformation policy on COVID-19. Reuters reporter Gloria So has more.
Twitter announced Sunday it's banning controversial U.S. lawmaker Marjorie Taylor Greene from the platform, making her the first congresswoman ever to be taken off Twitter. In a statement on messaging app Telegram, Greene accused Twitter of being, quote, an enemy to America, adding that social media platforms can't stop the truth from being spread far and wide. The Republican congresswoman from Georgia has previously faced short-term suspensions from Twitter over tweets which violated the platform's COVID-19 misinformation policy. At least two other Republican members of the House have been temporarily suspended from Twitter. Greene is a controversial figure who apologized last June for comparing mask mandates and vaccinations to the Holocaust. Her official congressional account remains active on Twitter with nearly 400,000 followers.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. Yemen's Houthi rebels say they have seized a ship carrying a United Arab Emirates flag in the Red Sea, and hackers targeted the website of an Israeli newspaper, the latest signs of a rise in Mideast tensions. The unidentified hackers replaced the Jerusalem Post's web content with an image that threatened a site associated with Israel's undeclared nuclear weapons program. The hacking comes on the Monday anniversary of the 2020 killing of a top Iranian general in a U.S. drone strike. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the hacking. The seizure of the vessel by Yemen's Iran-backed rebels is the latest attack in the Red Sea, a key trade route for international trade and energy shipments. A group of lawmakers loyal to China's Communist Party were sworn in to Hong Kong's legislature on Monday after an election was held without opposition candidates. The move comes after another pro-democracy news outlet announced it could no longer operate amid a growing crackdown on free speech in the territory. The former British colony, which was returned to China in 1997, was once known as a haven for dissent and freedom of the press and expression. The communist government in Beijing has clamped down over the past year, leading to closures of independent news outlets and the removal of monuments to dissent. Founders of Hong Kong media outlet Citizen News said the site will stop publishing on Tuesday. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is hospitalized in Sao Paulo for tests after experiencing abdominal pain. The hospital where he was admitted said the president had an intestinal obstruction and is in stable condition. Bolsonaro is said to be doing well. The 66-year-old leader has experienced a series of medical issues since he was stabbed in the stomach on the campaign trail in 2018. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says he tested positive for COVID-19 and is experiencing mild symptoms while quarantining at home. On Sunday night, Austin said he plans to attend key meetings and discussions virtually over the coming week. Austin says he was fully vaccinated and boosted a few months ago. A major fire at South Africa's parliament in Cape Town that sent a thick, dark plume of smoke into the sky and threatened the National Assembly building early Sunday seems to be under control. The fire broke out in one of the older buildings in Parliament's complex, forcing authorities to set up a security cordon near the cathedral where anti-apartheid Archbishop Desmond Tutu had been buried just hours before. Public Works Minister Patricia De Lille spoke to reporters, saying that contrary to what had been reported earlier, the National Assembly was still safe, as well as the visitors' entrance to Parliament.
The fire brigade and the fire services have got the situation under control. What you see behind me, it is not the National Assembly that's on fire. What is coming out there is an extractor that's pulling all the smoke from the old assembly out here over the National Assembly. So I thought I must just tell you the National Assembly is still safe. 120 Plain Street is still safe. And we're trying to contain the fire just where it is now.
There were no reports of casualties or injuries. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you think of planets, you probably picture them orbiting a star. But did you know there's a classification of planets called rogue, orphan, or nomad planets? These are planets that are much like those in our solar system, but rather than orbiting any star and being part of a planetary system, they are free-floating in space. Not many of these reclusive planets have been found, so they are considered to be quite rare. The European Southern Observatory reports that scientists who use several of their telescopes as well as other facilities have spotted at least 70 rogue planets that make up what they consider to be the largest group of orphan planets in the Milky Way. It's believed that these objects have been ejected from their original home planetary system at some time in the distant past. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Conservationists are blaming climate change, land clearing, and pesticides for the population crash of one of Australia's most famous insects. Once a common sight, bogong moths have become rare in recent years. They are now recognized as endangered by the world's leading scientific authority on vulnerable species, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The bogong moth is native to Australia. The mass migration of billions of the small insects has long been a spectacular sight in eastern Australia. Scientists say the moths are guided by the stars and the Earth's magnetic fields. They fly up to 1,000 kilometres from Queensland to the mountains of Victoria to shelter in caves from the heat of summer. In the caves, it was once estimated, there were as many as 17,000 moths per square metre. But Jess Abrahams, a nature campaigner from the Australian Conservation Foundation, says bogong moth numbers have collapsed.
It's a dramatic decline, and this population crash has been caused by climate change-fuelled extreme drought in their breeding grounds in Western Queensland. There's also been land clearing over many years, use of pesticides as well, and the consequence is a huge crash in numbers, and the flow-on effects to other species is of huge concern. This should be an alarm bell because we're in the midst of an extinction crisis. We're seeing million species globally at risk of extinction, and literally these things are disappearing before our very eyes.
The decline of the bogong moth has a cascading effect on other species. They were a major source of food for another critically endangered animal, the mountain pygmy possum. Fewer than 2,000 of Australia's only hibernating marsupials are thought to be left in the wild. The moth is one of 124 Australian animals and plants that were added in December to the Red List of Threatened Species, compiled by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. They include several other types of insects and the grey-headed flying fox, which is Australia's largest bat. The Red List classifies how close global animal, plant and fungi species are to dying out and includes sharks, rays and birds. Many populations are strained by global warming, deforestation, habitat loss and pollution. Campaigners are urging the Australian government to do more to save the moths that were once in such abundance in cities such as Sydney and Canberra that their vast numbers disrupted sporting events. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha, managing editor Kate Dawson, and the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
Straight Talk Africa, as we discuss the return of Africa's stolen art. France repatriated 26 looted colonial-era artifacts to Benin. Now museums in Europe and the US are rethinking what to do with their African art collections. We'll discuss art restitution and reparations. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa.